our 2024 year in review on episode 115 of So Many Insane Plays. Welcome to episode 115 of So Many Insane Plays, our 2024 year in review. I'm Kevin Crone with Stephen Menendian.
I can't believe it. How did the year go by so fast?
Indeed, indeed. Here's where I would normally plug, if you have questions or comments, you can tweet us. Well, we're not really following that Twitter account anymore. You can still try it. Email would be better at somanyinsanepodcast@gmail.com.
We're on Blueski individually.
That's right. We are individually on Blue Sky, and we've set up an account for the show under So Many Insane Plays as well.
I might keep a side eye on the Twitter account, but it's gotten a little crazy there.
That's right. The websites where you can find us are rapidly diminishing because MTGcast was recently retired, so we're no longer posting there. Eternal Central is only occasionally live. Jayco is not always updating that site, meaning if you're hearing us on that site, you may have been delayed a little bit in seeing the episode. And I'm currently searching for another platform on which to publish our show to replace MTGcast.
The mana drain has disappeared.
That's right.
At least there's good old iTunes. Well, if you really want to reach us, you can email us. Good old email.
That's right. That's right. If you're listening to us right now, though, we appreciate your diehard commitment to following the show. All right, let's move on to announcements. Steve, anything that you have to share with the audience today?
Well, I have been told that Jayco will update the vintage timeline, the vintage formats and vintage timeline. So it hasn't actually been updated since April, although I did an update in August. I've been told that that will be updated. So if you want to, again, bookmark the entire history of the format, every new set that makes, you know, notable printings, banned and restricted list changes, chronologically, that is it. The timeline of Vintage on Eternal Central. Go bookmark that. It should be updated by the time you are hearing this feed.
Excellent. Without further ado, let's talk about the year that was 2024.
And just to be clear, we're just talking about the Vintage format. We're not going to be giving you a a review of historical events in a broader sense.
A blow by blow, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You can read whatever news platform you'd like for that. So we're going to do this in several steps. First, we're actually going to cover the tentpole majors of the year, the major tournaments. Then we're going to do a dive into the sets that have been released, and then we're going to do a data analysis. So, and then from there, we're going to give out our annual Moxies Awards. So let's dive in, right, Kevin?
Sounds good. Let's go. You want to start with the MTGO vintage events?
Yes. So we're going to start with some MTGO events. And for those of you who don't regularly play on Magic Online, it can be a little confusing. In fact, it's darn right complicated. It's even when I was like playing pretty much weekly, it was complicated and confusing because of the naming conventions. So let me just give you a sense. The base of Magic Online for Vintage players is the format challenges and the Vintage leagues. So the format challenges refer to the cycle of events that happen on the weekends, one on Saturday and one on Sunday. For those of you who haven't played in a while, you'll remember the old Power 9 challenge. The original big Vintage event on Magic Online was the once a month Power 9 challenge. And then that became a weekly challenge, meaning it was every weekend. And then it became a Saturday and Sunday event, and then it turned into the format challenge because that wasn't giving out Power 9 anymore, it was giving out other prizes. So it made sense to change the name from the Power 9 challenge to the Vintage challenge. Mm-hmm. And then that was supplemented with eventually Vintage leagues, which are events that you can play throughout the week, you know, where it's like four rounds instead of a full blown Swiss plus top 8. So the base of the format, sort of the foundation of the format, are these format challenges, and there's what is the math on that? There's 104 a year. However, in what's called the Premier Play season, if the vintage format is selected as one of the Premier Play formats in a season, and there are three seasons per year, confusing, even more confusing, then three of those vintage challenges are turned into what are called showcase challenges, vintage showcase challenges. So basically, as I said, there are three seasons per year. And the year basically, Kevin, runs like the academic year. It's confusing, but it basically this year it actually started November 27th and runs through August 25th, or November 25th rather. So it's not quite a calendar year. It kind of syncs up, you know. There's three seasons per year. That's all you need to know. Mm-hmm. And in 2024, one of the seasons included vintage as a featured format. Only season one, to the best of my knowledge. And therefore, because of that, Kevin, if you're tracking all of this, the normal vintage challenge that would have been played on January 20th, February 17th, and March 16th, so one of the January events, one of the February events, and one of the March events, was turned from the regular, again, vintage format challenge to what's called the vintage showcase challenge. And these are huge events because you build up your play points and challenges and so forth in order to get entry into these events. And once you, and just to explain the system, okay, bear with me, this is going to be hard to grok in audio, but hopefully you understand what I'm saying. The vintage format challenge was turned into a vintage showcase challenge. And if you top 8 the vintage showcase challenge, you are then given entry into the vintage showcase qualifier, which happened.
What are you qualifying for?
Yeah, I'll explain that in a second, but that happened March 30th. So, you know, so you all of the top 8 players from those events get into the vintage showcase qualifier. And the vintage showcase qualifier, according to our data, only had 30 players. I'm not quite sure why. The math is 24 players, but there are probably some additional ways to get into that. Maybe there was like some sort of open that allowed you to get into that, or on a leaderboard or something else. Anyway, what it qualifies for is once you get into the showcase, the vintage showcase qualifier, if you top 8 that, you actually qualify for the Champions Showcase and the next Tabletop Pro Tour. So what is the Champion Showcase? The Champion Showcase is the basically end of the season main event on Magic Online. It's an 8-player online event, and the competitors are the winner of each of the 4 showcase qualifiers, the 2 showcase opens, and 2 leaderboard invites. If you win there, Kevin, you get an invite to the Magic World Championship.
Okay.
So it's basically a way that vintage players and vintage online can start from a showcase challenge, and then essentially through winning that, getting into the qualifier, champion showcase qualifier, winning that, getting into the showcase challenge, winning that, then getting into the Magic Online Champion Showcase, which we just said, you win that, you get into the World Championship. So it's 3 steps removed from getting into the World Championship.
Okay.
Now,
we're not going to report on the ultimate tournament.
No, we're not going to report on the Champion Showcase because it's not vintage. But we are going to report on the Showcase Challenge, which replaced the Format Challenge, and the Champion Showcase Qualifier, which qualifies you for the Champion Showcase. Now, if it's confusing to you, it's because it is confusing. Even when you participated in this, it's confusing. So, Kevin, the showcase challenges, I just a note on this. I don't know if this is always the case, but according to the current Premier Play webpage, it says that Modern, Legacy, and Standard are always showcase formats, and then there's a 4th format that rotates depending upon the season. And in season one of 2024, it was vintage. And also in season one coming up, it will also be vintage in 2025. The website does say, however, that season two, the fourth format will be Pauper, and then season three, the fourth format will be Pioneer. Just a heads up. So that explains why vintage does not always have a pathway to the Champion Showcase. Just wanted to note that, and it's also a forward-looking note for those who are thinking about playing Magic Online in the winter of 2025. It's a good time to do so because Vintage is featured in the Champions Showcase pathway.
Excellent.
Let me say one other thing at the risk of truly losing everyone. There are two other separate layers to Vintage on Magic Online. In addition to everything we mentioned, there's also a thing called the Vintage Qualifier and Vintage Super Qualifier. And that has nothing to do with this Showcase Challenge or the Champion Showcase. It actually gets you into your local regionals. So it's a feeder tournament for regionals. But it also, the reason we mention this is because the Vintage Qualifiers happen irregularly. They're like at 7 a.m. instead of 10 a.m. They do not replace a Vintage Challenge. They're separate. And the Super Qualifier is basically a much larger and deeper version of that, and it's the largest version. So we're going to note that as one of our tentpole majors of the tournaments of the year. It's just one of the biggest Vintage tournaments of the year. But it's not a regular qualifier.
Which happened to be the last tournament of the year also.
Right. So we'll get to that last in our tournament coverage. But we're going to do here is we're going to go through 9 events that we deemed, you know, I call them majors. You know, if you've been listening to this podcast for a while, the majors have historically been the Waterbury, the NYSE, the Vintage Championships, and I don't know, Kevin, like the Bazaar of Moxon, you know, that sort of level of event. Here, what we're calling the majors are the Vintage Showcase Challenge, the Showcase Qualifier, the NYSE, the 3 Eternal Weekend Vintage Championships, and then the Vintage Super Qualifier. So we've got 9 tournaments to talk about. And if we got it wrong, if there are others you think should have qualified, email us and we'll try and include them in future years. But we did the best we could today, you know, trying to assemble all of the most important tournaments of the year. And we have everything in our data set, but these are the ones that we've deemed worth sort of special mention. So, Kevin, anything you're confused on?
No, I think you did as well as you can, given the format and the material you're working with.
the stupid appellations and naming conventions. I know, it's infuriating, but that's what it is. Okay, so let's start, Kevin, with the January Vintage Showcase Challenge, January 20th. How many players do we have? Go ahead, give us the top 8 and the number of players for it, Kevin. Go ahead.
We had 200 players, and the top 8 included a pair of Jewel Shops, 3 Lurrus decks of a couple of different varieties, Oath, Doomsday, and Aggro Shops.
Yes, and this is not long after the Vintage Championship of 2024, right?
Eternal Weekend. Not long at all.
So, and the winner was the same thing that won the Vintage Championship the preceding month or two, Jewel Shops. So Jewel Shops sort of comes out of the gate pretty strong in 2025, according to this limited snapshot. We'll look at the larger pattern in a bit. But that is a tentpole event. That's pretty impressive. 2 Jewel Shops, and it wins the event.
Mm-hmm.
200 players is, again, not shabby at all. Big, big Vintage tournament.
Definitely.
Moving a month later, February 17th, the second Vintage Showcase Challenge. Again, this replaces one of the Vintage format challenges. And again, there's 2 Vintage format challenges per week, one on Saturday, one on Sunday. This was on February 17th. 205 players, so slightly more. And the top 8, Kevin, was?
This time, only 1 Jewel Shops, only 1 Lurrus Saga, 2 Initiative decks, PO, Dredge, Doomsday, and Breach.
So a much more variety. Representative sample of the format. And the winner?
The winner was one of my favorite usernames, 416 Frowning Table on Lurrus Saga.
So Lurrus Saga won that. So we see the emergence of Lurrus Saga, you know, back at the top of the metagame. Next month, the third and final Vintage Showcase Challenge. And again, every format that's selected for the Showcase Challenge and Premier Play gets 3 of these. The final one, Only 182 players, still in striking distance of 200-205. And the eight players, Kevin. Oh, and I think if you actually win these, I think if you win two of these, the invitation to the qualifier goes, like, passes down, if I recall, by the way.
Oh.
But go ahead, Kevin. Go ahead. What's the top eight?
Three Lurrus Sagas, Jewel Shops, Dredge, Initiative, and two Bug Decks.
Very nice. So we see more Lurrus Saga, still a Jewel Shop, and the winner is
Benny Boo on Jewel Shops.
So two Jewel Shop wins in those big events, one Lurrus Saga event. I think that Saga, that kind of gives you a snapshot of that quarter in a sense. So
it really does.
The Vintage Showcase qualifier is at the very end of the quarter, March 30th. And according to our notes, Kevin, it says 30 players competed in that. We're still including it because, again, you have to top eight basically a 200-person vintage tournament to get into this event. So it's right. Highly competitive. I played in one of these a couple years ago. I qualified for one of these and really enjoyed playing in this qualifier. It was very intense and very fun. The one I played in, I think, was, it was like right around the new year in, was it 2022, I want to say? Maybe 2021. Anyway, Kevin, what was the top eight? Do we actually have the full breakdown of the decks in that event?
We do, but I don't have it in front of me
no,
right
no
now.
No problem. Okay, so what's the top eight?
Top eight. Two more Jewel Shops. Three Lurrus decks, although one of them was a DRS variant. Then we've got Sphere Shops, so that's an aggro shops list, Doomsday, and Initiative.
Nice little breakdown there. No Bug this time, no Dredge this time, no Initiative, no Breach rather. They've won Initiative. Mm-hmm. And the winner of that, who qualified then, but I just remind you, the winner of this qualifies for the Champion Showcase and won a Pro Tour invite. So, yep. And by the way, again, remember, the Champion Showcase is only eight players. And the winner of that gets automatic invitation to the World Championship. So I didn't track which to is, see who this how this person did, but yeah. Kevin, who was the winner of this?
The same Benny Bo on Jewel Shops, who won the prior Showcase Challenge.
Pretty.
Just 2 weeks prior.
Pretty cool. Pretty cool.
So, yeah, nice showing.
So Jewel Shops did pretty darn well in Q1 when just looking at the bigger tournaments. It did. Lurrus Saga actually has the more top eight appearances in these four events, if I'm counting.
That's right.
But Jewel Shops won.
Lurrus was ascendant at this time, but Jewel was still doing very well.
Yes. Okay. Thank you for bearing with me through this. Now I'm going to hand it off to you to talk about some of the big paper events.
That's right. After Q1, we move into a bit of a drought, and then thankfully we get to NYSE in late June. NYSE, the New York Stock Exchange, as you know, is a tradition that Steve alluded to earlier.
I played in, I think, the first five of them, and I won. I top eighted two of them. They're great.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, this year, and for a basically player organized paper vintage event in the real world, this is a healthy showing at 108 players. And the top eight for this event, Steve, do you want to run down this top eight for us?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Thank you. Yeah, the top eight was four Esper Lurrus, AJ Grasso on Jewel Shops, and then Bosch and Roll on Oath, and then two deck lists that MTG Melee are missing. So, but and these Esper Lurrus decks are quite different in the particularities, but that's six of the eight.
Yeah, this is continuing a pattern that we'll see throughout the year, which will be codified in a more realistic way here in a couple of minutes we'll talk about. But Lurrus decks demonstrated a lot of different construction variants throughout the year, and that continues from beginning to end.
Definitely.
And it was won by?
It was won by Bosch and Roll on Oath.
Congratulations. Many time Eternal Weekend top eighter, Bosch and Roll, who had a pretty darn good year, I would say.
Yes, I would agree with that. He always has a good year, though.
Well, especially lately, though. I mean, he's really on a tear from an Eternal Magic standpoint. So then we get into another drought, basically. That was late June, and the next tentpole events are the sequence of Eternal Weekend events throughout the globe that kick off in October with North America Vintage Champs. So on October 12th in America, we had 407 players. Let me repeat that. 407 players.
Wow. Yeah.
That is a very healthy player count. That makes this event like two of the giant online showcase challenges together. And
by far the biggest event of the year.
It was an epic event, yeah. And Steve, you and I had a great time casting this event, which we normally do. Yeah. And we got to join the likes of luminaries like Reed Duke in that process, which was a ton of fun.
Okay. So, yeah, North, we had great fun covering the Vintage Championship. The top eight was 3 Esper Loris, 2 Jeweled Shops, 1 Dimir Loris, 1 Doomsday, and 1 Oath. And man, it was, what matches did we cover, Kevin? We covered, I think we covered in the top eight, Doomsday versus, do you remember what they played?
It was Doomsday, yeah, versus Esper Loris, because Lavinia was involved.
Yeah, and I thought we thought Doomsday was going to win, despite.
Yeah, that was a tight match, lots of low resource games. Yeah.
And then we covered the Oath deck on a tear to the finals, if I recall.
That's right.
And then but then
we saw him get stymied by having boarded out Gaea's Blessing, God. If you recall.
Yes.
Yeah. A tragic way to lose.
it was a great top eight. It was I know I say that a lot, but this truly was a great top eight. It was really intriguing to see it play out, fun, mm-hmm. well represented the format. And then the winner were there, besides Max winning, who were some of the notable players in the top eight? Just remind me, that have ever occurred in these events. I think Bosch and Rold fell outside the top eight, right? He did not make it.
He did fall into the top 16 or 32. And but one name that our audience might remember is Dave Kaplan. Longtime vintage player Dave Kaplan was one of the Esper Loris decks in this top eight.
I'm
yeah.
pretty sure I played Dave Kaplan in the Swiss the year I won the Vintage Championship in 2007. So longtime player for sure.
Yeah.
But just gargantuan tournament. Probably one of the larger Vintage Championships of all time. I mean, I think the record is somewhere near 500, but 407 players is just absolutely enormous. it's a huge event.
I agree. And the winner?
And the winner was Max Gilmore on Esper Loris. So pretty impressive, especially after the restrictions we're going to cover, wouldn't you say?
Well, that's right. And it's one of the narratives of this year is the progression of Loris and in the face of key impactful restrictions. And that's one of the things we're going to talk about more later.
For sure.
So next up, only about a week and a half later, is the Asia Vintage Champs. And not quite as big as North America, but still 194 players. It's amazing to me to get these numbers that are close to 200, like the online qualifiers or the online challenges, I should say. And that's just an impressive showing for the Asia Vintage Champs.
Quite.
And the top eight, Steve?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to spoil this, but the Asia Vintage Champs was larger than the European one. So, and the winner was, oh God, Yuta Yokokawa on Esper Loris.
And talk about how many Loris were in this top eight.
Well, again, 3, depending on how you count. So there was 2 Esper Loris, a Loris with Deathrite Shaman, a Jewel Shop, a Workshop PO without Jewel, a Doomsday, an Oath deck, and then an Oops All Spells deck.
Quite the cross-section of the format, but still heavily tilted toward Loris.
Yeah, I like this sort of, it gives you a little Japanese flavor there, a little, you know, mm-hmm. variety that you wouldn't.
If you're looking for something clever to play in the format still today, go look at that Workshop PO list that is not Jewel. It has Glaring Fleshrakers where it would have coveted Jewels. It's a really interesting build.
Fascinating.
Yeah. So then a couple of weeks later in early December.
Well, Kevin, before we get to December, it's interesting that Loris won both the Asia and North American Vintage Championship. So that kind of tells you the swing in the fall, right? As we mm-hmm. go from fall to winter. So in the winter.
That's right.
Now we're almost at winter. Technically, winter starts, I think this year it was December 20th because we were in a mm-hmm. leap year. Normally it's the 21st. So the European Vintage Championship occurred, the Vintage Championship was held on December 8th, And we only had 155 players. So Europe, which used to be the epicenter of vintage, is now the laggard.
Yeah. I don't know if that's... we haven't really tracked this year over year since they've been doing the global vintage champs. We should look at that sometime soon to see what these trends are like.
Compile the year over year. Yeah.
Yeah.
So 155 players. Kevin, you give us the top eight now and then the winner.
Well, tell me if you've heard this one before. Three Luris decks, two Esper and one Dimir, one Jewel Shops, one Dredge, Initiative, Doomsday. So two Initiative lists. And the winner was one Samuel Mistigatz. I'm hoping I'm getting that name pronounced correct. On Dredge.
Wow.
Dark Horse champion, Dredge.
Wow.
We're going to talk about the positioning of Dredge within the metagame a little bit when we get to some of our... other information about the progression of the year. Dredge had a really interesting year in Vintage. Let me just put it that way. And this is the highlight right here, this victory in the European Vintage Champs. So last but not least, Steve, you mentioned it earlier, the last prominent event of the year, in fact, it might have been the last major Vintage or measurable Vintage event of the year on December 28th.
Yes, the Vintage Super Qualifier.
Super Qualifier.
Yep.
241 players.
So the largest Vintage event of the year.
Online.
Yeah, sorry. I meant Magic Online. The largest Vintage Magic Online event. And just to remind you again, let me just say this. The qualifiers, which are separate from the showcase pathway, the first and second place player in the qualifier get invited to the regional championship in Paper Magic, Tabletop Magic. Mm. And then the super qualifiers, the difference is they're the top four are invited to the next regional championship. So the super qualifier has twice as many qualifications, and we're not reporting the qualifier events. We're reporting just the super qualifiers here.
Yes, very super indeed.
So Kevin, go ahead.
This top eight, again, stop me if you've heard this one. Esper Luris, Blue Black Luris, Esper Luris, Esper Luris, and Luris PO. That was five Luris decks in the top eight of this event, plus a Jewel Shops, an Initiative, and a Doomsday.
Wow.
And the winner is friend of the show, longtime Vintage champ, Montolio on Esper Luris.
Pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Congratulations again for continued success, Montolio. And this really puts a cap on the year in terms of the progression of archetypes. And Esper Luris, coming in strong with a five, not just Esper, but Luris decks putting five in the top eight of the largest Magic Online event of the year.
Yeah.
It's pretty notable.
That's really, really incredible. Let me just say for completeness sake, if you do want to look up these events, the non-super qualifier for Vintage, there was a regular Vintage qualifier that was held on Saturday, August 31st. But I think that's the only one. So there was one Vintage qualifier and then one Vintage super qualifier, as far as I can tell. So I am certain, I'd be shocked if the super qualifier wasn't by far the biggest event of the year. So pretty impressive.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Steve, any summary takeaways from this progression across the year of events and their construction in terms of top eights and winners?
I really enjoy looking at Vintage from a tentpole perspective. We're going to go to the grassroots next. Well, not next, but after in the third step. But I want to hesitate from drawing too many broad inferences or conclusions, but it definitely seems like there has been a metagame battle going on over the course of the year between the Luris decks, the Jewel Shop decks, and a couple other things, and with Luris just coming out on top, right? I mean, there have been some things that have been hanging in there, like Oath and so forth, but it just appears that Luris has just been the best deck.
Well, you're right. We will get into that in a little bit more detail here as we go. But before we do want to talk about just the progression of sets that were released this year and other maybe notable impacts on the format.
Oh, sorry, Kevin. Yeah. Sorry, before that, I do want to mention that the Vintage Qualifier Tournament, which I mentioned on August 31st, had 105 players. And just for completeness, I will mention it was won by Jewel Shops.
Gotcha. Which puts it near the top of the large tournaments this year, but still, I think, what does that put it in? Sixth place? terms of Magic Online events?
Yeah, I mean, it's smaller than everything we mentioned, except for the 30-player event, which you had to top 8 to qualify for. So, yeah, it's sort of in the middle. It's a mezzo tournament.
One of the stories of this year, Steve, is that while there are several cards that we're going to talk about that were impactful to the format, and I think that list is fairly sizable this year, with different levels of impact on different archetypes and a broad range. But in terms of set impacts, gosh, our Moxie for set is going to have a hard time this year. A hard time, that is, to be an interesting discussion is the way I should put it, because starting with January of this year, we had a reprint set, which was Ravnica Remastered. Obviously, that doesn't introduce anything into the format. The first new cards of the year came in February with Murders at Karlov Manor.
Yes.
Large set, 286 cards, and there were some impactful things from that set. But that really began a bit of a flurry, because while not all these sets had major impacts on the format, there were a lot of them this year. Just a month after that, the Fallout set came out in March. Another 150 cards that were new. And even though that was not released in booster packs, and, you know, there weren't play boosters, or it's not designed for draft or whatever, it did still have 150 new cards that were eligible for Vintage. And just a month after that, we had Outlaws at Thunder Junction, 276 cards, which in Outlaws of Thunder Junction, if depending on how you count, was the 100th expansion for Magic the Gathering.
Wow, yeah. We did mention that, I think, in one of our...
Yep.
Yeah, pretty cool.
And there was not a lot of Sturm and Drang about that, but it is fairly notable. 100 expansions. Then in June, we got the Haymaker of the Year, Modern Horizons 3. And as we've come to know, Modern Horizons sets tend to be Vintage Horizons sets lately.
Yeah.
And this one definitely had its own strong impact on the format, which we'll talk about more later.
So we're not going to go through the notable cards yet from the sets?
No, we'll get to that. We'll get to that a little later in our Moxies. Yeah. So shortly after that, in July, Assassin's Creed came out, which you might think, oh, that's not very impactful. 104 new cards for Vintage, none of which really made an impact. August had Bloomborough. So just month over month, new set after new set.
There's a lot of 281 cards.
And just a month after that, in September, we had Duskmourne, another 286 new cards.
The House of Horror.
That's right. The first 9 months of this year were just banger after banger in terms of high quantity of new cards entering the Vintage format. But it was not all in this, you know, the same degree of impactful, which we'll talk about more later. Fortunately, we got to skip a month in October, basically. Then in November, Magic Foundations came out. Now, Foundations, which is the new take on the core set, didn't have as many new cards because it was a mixture of new cards and old. So it was 139 cards. And that was the last major set of the year, Foundations. There was also a Secret Lair, the Marvel Secret Lair, which introduced 4 mechanically unique cards, but they won't have any impact on Vintage.
The Marvel Secret Lair drop did happen a week before, it was 10 days before Foundations.
Before Vintage Champs?
No, before...
Before Foundations, yeah. Gotcha. Yeah. So, numerically speaking, in terms of quantity of new cards, this year was probably an all-time high. I don't have it actually analyzed year over year. I'm sure the Magic Data Science folks do. But it was a big year in terms of quantity of new cards. Set after set, multiple universes beyond sets, and I don't know if this is going to continue to this level going forward, but any year there's a Modern Horizons set, you know, you can expect some fireworks.
Absolutely.
But there were three other key announcements throughout this year that impact the structure and content of the format. Well, really only two of them changed things. In March, we had the unrestriction of Ponder, which was obviously notable from a historic standpoint. Yeah, and a little bit surprising. But as we predicted at the time, it did not have a major, major impact on the format. There are a couple of archetypes, notably Doomsday, which benefit primarily from this. Yeah, and Oath. But those decks did not show a dominant shift in their metagame positioning as a result of this. Similarly, although even more bombastically, in August, we had a Banned and Restricted announcement, which included the restriction of Urza's Saga and Vexing Bauble. Now, big change there in terms of deck construction, in terms of impact of the format, in terms of how you approach the format. And yet, it did not actually reposition from an archetype standpoint, the format in a significant way, which we'll see when we talk about the monthly results. There was yet another announcement this year, which just happened in December, but there were no changes for Vintage, which I think was a good thing. This Urza's Saga Vexing Bauble change is a really, really interesting one, Steve. And we could talk about more details here in a minute. But have we ever seen a shift like that that was simultaneously so impactful from a numbers standpoint and so unimpactful from a metagame standpoint? It's so weird.
Say that one more time.
Like, so many decks were impacted by these changes, because these were tentpole cards in all the major archetypes, right? In one way or another. From a main deck to a sideboard, like, everyone was impacted, and yet almost nothing shifted.
Yeah.
Like, some deck construction techniques in Saga decks, the Lurrus decks, I mean, and some numbers here and there, obviously, with the baubles, some of the 4X bauble decks were hurt, but it just didn't cause a major shift in the players.
You mean in terms of the sort of top eight representation?
Yeah.
It didn't seem to shake up the metagame and put it on a reset the trajectory, at least visibly.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, let's turn to the data, and then let's make that case more clearly. Before we turn to the data, do you want to talk about the individual cards first, or are we doing that after the data?
I say we do that after.
Okay. Let's look at the data.
That when we get into the Moxies, yeah. So from a total year perspective, when you combine at the archetype level, and this archetype level includes things like aggro, and bazaars, blue control, and combo and shops, things like that, there was a fair bit of uniformity across the whole year. The most represented from a percentage of metagame standpoint was shops at 22%, but not far behind, clustered in at the 15 to 16 realm where, let's see, what's next? Blue control, 15.5. Bazaars at 15.5.
I love
aggro at 16.
I love the consistency of like that 20 to 25% shops all the time.
That's right. A thing we've discussed historically for years now. What this tells me is that there was no, while there was one deck who was outperforming the rest of the herd by a little bit, it was not to the 35-40% degree that we've seen in years past. And again, these archetype groupings group a couple different decks together that you might not necessarily treat the same. Workshops is chief among them. You know, there's some things under that umbrella. But the bottom line is that this format still has lots of room for interaction from a deck construction standpoint. Lots of room to respond to winners from prior events and adjust your sideboard and gain some incremental advantage, that kind of thing. And I still think that the format is very healthy in that respect. Now, some might argue that Lurrus has become a little too dominant. We can talk about that. But the bottom line is there's multiple variants of Lurrus that you can interact with in meaningfully different ways as well. So over the course of the year, there was a constellation of decks in a couple of different, along a couple different metrics that we like to measure. One of which is metagame percentage, where there were three key groupings. And one of which is match win percent, of which there were also a couple of key groupings, although that gets a little muddier. In terms of metagame percent, we talked about it already in the archetype level, but at the deck level, Lurrus Saga, which has a couple of variants, Jewel Shops, Initiative, and Dredge were all up in the 12 to 15% range. Jewel Shops was the most, followed by Saga and Initiative, with Dredge following a little bit behind. But those four archetypes
really constitute...
They constitute the majority of the metagame. There is a big gulf between the fifth place metagame representation, which is Oath, at around 7%. That's a big gulf. And just behind Oath are things like Doomsday and Bug and Breach. Those two groupings really differentiated themselves from the rest of the metagame, because the next highest thing is down in the 2 to 3% range. But they also differentiated themselves in terms of match win percentage from one to the other. Because among the top four, Lurrus Saga had an annual match win percent of, 54%.
That's just
shy of 54%.
It's very, very
which
good.
Which is for a whole year.
Incredible.
That's a very strong performance.
Dominant. I mean, not necessarily dominant in terms of, you know, to maintain anything over like a 53 or 50, even 52 win percentage is considered, you know, in a large sample over time means that you're winning a lot of tournaments.
That's right. That's right. The jewel shops
So Kevin, let me just see if we can summarize before you get too specific here. So what, give me the top three decks in terms of metagame proportion and then top three decks in terms of win percentage.
Metagame proportion, it goes jewel shops, then saga, then initiative, all very closely grouped in the 13 to 15 kind of range.
Okay, for the entire year.
Yeah. Yes.
And what about match win percentage?
Match win percentage is a little trickier. The top performer is actually Turbo Vault Key, but it had representation.
Let's say over 5% of the metagame. Let's create a cutoff.
Okay. Yeah. If we cut off at 5%, then the top performer is actually, gosh, it's a 1-2 tie between Doomsday and Lurrus Saga. Doomsday, Lurrus Saga had that 53.5, as I said earlier. Doomsday had 53.8, so Doomsday takes first by, you know, 0.5%.
Yeah.
But those two really distinguish themselves because the next two, there's a gap down to Breach and Jewel Shops, which you have to get down to 51.5. So there's a pretty significant difference.
But Lurrus Saga had over twice the representation of Doomsday and just slightly worse win percentage. So
that's right. To be that close on win percentage, but yeah, to be twice as much represented in the metagame is a pretty big gulf. It's a much better performance.
I have no problem designating Lurrus Saga the best performer of the year, just in terms of data, despite not winning, as we saw. I mean, so it won. It did. Esper Lurrus did win the North American Vintage Championship and the Asia Vintage Championship.
Yep.
But it didn't win. I mean, and it won the.
And it did win. It did win one of the showcases,
too. Yeah, the showcase challenge. So, yeah, pretty good. What was the overall win percentage for Jewel Shops again? 51.54%, so 51.5%. Not bad.
Right.
And again, 14.6% of the metagame. So even a larger proportion of the metagame than Lurrus.
Than Lurrus, yeah. But in terms of the two, I weight a significant jump in match win percent for a whole year that is 2%, like that's a significant jump.
Oh yeah,
having a few more percentage points of representation is not nearly as impactful in my eyes.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, thank you, Kevin. I know this is very hard for people to follow. Is there anything else you want to say before? I mean, that's what I'm trying to summarize it. Is there anything else you want to say before we talk about the cards and then we'll give away the Moxies?
Just that. Over the course of the year, there were, you know, Lurrus Saga and Jewel Shops from a month-to-month basis really did jockey for position in terms of their top representation from a top 8 percentage across all of the paper and Magic Online results. There was one month, that being April, where in terms of top 8 percentage, Lurrus Saga topped out at 37%. Which is a pretty high individual month. No other month was above 30%, though. And what's also worth note that at the time of the restriction of Saga and Vexing Bauble in August, the vintage data collection community took an opportunity to disaggregate some of the deck labels because Lurrus was getting so granular. And so starting in August of this year, the community started tracking decks with some slightly different monikers and more granular detail of the Lurrus decks. And all that, I only point that out to point out that if you're the sort of person who wants to dig into the data, which the community makes available in a Google Sheet, then you're going to notice that happening in August of this year. It doesn't change the fact, however, that Lurrus continued to perform very well throughout the year. And more often than not, having a better top 8 percentage and a better match win percent than Jewel Shops.
Yep. So that's, I think, a perfect place to break and move on to our next segment, Kevin.
Yeah. It's time for our 2024 Moxie Awards.
So, let's remind everyone the categories. The categories are the best new cards, the best deck. The categories are the best new card, the best new set, the best overall deck, and then the best storyline.
And the last one is purposefully ambiguous. We have fun with that every year.
Indeed. So, Kevin, let's start with new cards. So you set up the fact that there are just a ton of new sets that were introduced, and not only introduced into the sort of Magic chronology, but also into the vintage format. So what are the notable cards? And do it, if you could, try and do it by set.
So, starting early in the year at Murders at Karlov Manor, the notable cards, our list here is not fully comprehensive in terms of every card that possibly saw play, because if it was fewer than, say, 50 to 100 decks throughout the year, I just didn't include it in our list. But the top cards in terms of representation for Murders at Karlov Manor are the new lands, the Surveil lands. Most notably, Undercity Sewers, which, being blue-black, was destined to be the number one of that category, but also included Meticulous Archive, which saw some play in the
How much do these cards see play? Is it marginal? Is it like, you know, Mishra's Factory, or I don't know, or is it like
there is healthy representation by specifically Undercity Sewers because of how dominant blue-black is in the vintage metagame this year, and there is sparse representation of Meticulous Archive, which is the blue-white version, and then the other three need not apply.
Fair enough. Underground Sea and Tundra, there it is.
Yeah, exactly. Fairly predictably, and it's also worth noting that even though there are 10 lands in that cycle, we didn't see any of the other ones you might think of, like the Tropical Island variant, Hedge Maze. That did not really show up. So, to your point, Murders at Karlov Manor brought us the Surveil lands and notably Undercity Sewers.
Great.
Then, in terms of, you know, sequentially, chronologically throughout the year, next up is Modern Horizons 3.
Which means, just by the way, nothing notable from Ravnica Clue, nothing from Fallout, nothing from Outlaws of Thunder Junction, nothing from the... right, none of that.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. Now, that's not to say that no cards saw play from those sets. It's just that the numbers are so small that they're not in contention for our moxies here.
They're not viable nominees.
That's right. Okay. For example, Outlaws of Thunder Junction brought us that new that new rule of law called High Noon. That card was a flash in the pan. But no, not enough numbers to matter.
Okay.
But what did bring us numbers, and predominantly so, was Modern Horizons 3. I've got, and this is just
biggies.
Above the threshold.
Give us the biggies first. The
biggies are Vexing Bauble, as we've discussed, which got restricted, mind you, Psychic Frog, Consigned to Memory, and Sink into Stupor. Those are the biggies from Modern Horizons 3. And you could probably make an honorable mention for Witch Enchanter. All those cards saw major archetype impacts. Some were a bit of a slow burn, actually, but major archetype impacts across the major archetypes in the format. Lurrus, Jewel Shops, and Initiative, for example.
Yeah. It's amazing. So, like, the Disenchant is the creature is the more marginal here.
That's right.
But the other ones were, you know, obviously highly disruptive, Vexing Bauble, Psychic Frog, like the most insane Ophidian ever printed.
that's right.
How would you characterize Consigned to Memory and Sink into Stupor?
So the Consigned to Memory is very interesting because it took people a little while to cotton on to the fact that it interacts with so much of the format.
Right.
I'm not saying everyone was blind to the fact, just that the number of applications that it has, is, you know, it's kind of growing every day. It's the sort of card that's going to get better over time as new and better abilities and artifacts, you know, come to fore in the format.
It's become a permanent staple is what you're saying.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. I think it's here to stay.
Yeah.
And you know, it's fighting with perennial all-stars like Steel Sabotage. I mean, think about that. Steel Sabotage is an all-star from a sideboard standpoint in particular, and has ebbed and flowed over the course of the format, of course, in concert with how good workshop decks are. But for the fact that Consigned to Memory could displace, and to a significant degree, Steel Sabotage is just immediately noteworthy in and of itself. And Sink into Stupor, we've talked about, is it, I have two thoughts on it.
Such a weird card from my perspective, but go ahead.
No, I think I'm with you. One, it's an MDFC and it's blue, which means it is immediately
MDFC
worth considering.
It stands for
Modal Double Face card, a card that is one thing on either side and you can choose which side to play. The fact that it is a blue card of irrelevant text on one side means that it pitches to all the forces.
Yes.
And the fact that it is a blue land on the other side means that it just has universal applications. When we reviewed it at release, we talked about how it could replace Seagate Restoration.
Yes.
As the blue card, blue
Oops.
Land du jour in
Oops.
In no not in well in Oops 2, but more importantly in Jewel Shops.
Yeah.
And it just so happens that that has come to pass completely. Now it is it's a four of in Jewel Shops.
It's an island that pitches to Force of Will. and
That's
in
right.
like Belcher type decks, it just allows you to have, you know, the force without having to have the land.
Yeah. Yes, it plays a perfect role in Oops, and you're not wrong about that. But Oops is a tiny part of the metagame
right.
compared to the much more dominant application.
This is kind of an example of like, well, remind me what Seagate Restoration does besides being a land. I can't remember the active
yeah,
part of it.
It's 7 mana, and you draw cards equal to the number of cards in your hand plus 1.
Yeah.
So it's like a concentrate.
It was a blue blank
for 7 mana.
Until, yeah, it was just a...
for the most part, yeah. It rarely went onto the stack. And Sink of the Stupor is much more synergy and much more utility in that in Jewel Shop's home.
Yeah.
But so those are the heavy hitters from MH3. And the only other card that even must apply in this conversation is from Bloomborough a couple months later. And that's Into the Flood Maw. But its count is still, it pales in comparison to those other MH3 cards. So just for reference, again, I've cut off here to the top 9 cards. Is it 9?
Yeah.
No, strike that. Yeah, 9. Of those, 7 are MH3. One yeah. murders, one Bloomer.
And when we actually do a proportional analysis mathematically, it's going to be very hard to evaluate Vexing Bauble because it was only legal for 3 months. So it's like it was released on June 14th, and then it was restricted effective uh-huh. August 25th or 26th. So... it only existed for like, you know,
yeah,
well, 2.5 months.
And and you're right about that. But for the purposes of this breakdown, I'm counting total deck, not total quantity of the cards,
right.
but appearances
decks.
In decks. And like it or not, Vexing Bauble continued to be a staple.
It still
of the
is.
Format.
It still exists.
Yeah.
It just it's not like it disappeared
yeah, dramatically differently.
Yeah.
Yep. And in conjunction with Saga too, you know, it, as we discussed before, and as everyone well knows, it plays a different role now.
Let's move on to the other sets. So, Assassin's Creed, nothing there, I assume.
No, there are no other cards. Fallout, Assassin's Creed,
Duskmourn,
like nothing else reached the level of these cards, and in particular, MH3.
Yeah.
And I have sorted this list by.
But what about Foundations? Anything interesting there?
No,
okay.
Nothing worthwhile in Foundations either.
Well,
I've sorted this list by appearances per month of legality.
I love that.
So
we talked about that last year. Yeah,
that's right. It's a new metric we've developed to account for the fact that things are released midway through the year. And if Vexing Bauble had been banned, for example, rather than restricted, I would have curtailed its time to just that period. But that's not the case. And so what you have is. The one murders card on the list here, Undercity Sewers, was legal for most of the year.
This data is pretty insane, by the way. Go ahead.
It really is. The one murders card, Undercity Sewers, has been legal for most of the year, 11 months out of the year. And it put up 1,000 showings, 959,
yeah.
which comes out to about 87 a month. that's a pretty healthy representation. For comparison... last year, when we evaluated the One Ring at this time, it only had 95 appearances a month. So think about that. They
wow.
both came out in June of their respective years.
What was that? What was our card of the year last year? Remind me.
Well, aforementioned One Ring was our card of the year last year, with very similar appearances to this Undercity Sewers, and now obviously they play dramatically different roles. I don't want to draw any further comparison to the two, but. The One Ring was not the most numerous card of the results last year. In fact, it was third on the list in terms of monthly appearances. But I mentioned that just because this Undercity Sewers is a very healthy representation. It's showing up very frequently in Doomsday. It's become a staple in Doomsday for its card selection and in some cases tricky interactions with Doomsday itself. And just in general, it's also showing up occasionally in Lurrus decks. So that's a healthy showing from a middle-of-the-pack card in our list this year. It's also the top performing card from a count standpoint in terms of deck appearances of non-MH3 cards. The top four above it are all from MH3. And they are, in ascending order, Sink into Stupor at 88 per month. It's a pretty narrow card, but it's thoroughly represented to become a staple in jewel shops, as we discussed. Third on the list, Consigned to Memory, with 198 appearances per month. Think about that.
Wow.
200 per month for Consigned to Memory. Of note, last year's number one card, Lorraine revealed, was 209 per month.
Wow.
So think about that. We have three cards this year
that exceed,
that have the quantity of appearances that our top one did last year on a on a monthly basis. And by comparison, Urza's Saga only has 166 appearances per month over, you know, deck wise over the same year. So Consigned to Memory is another, call it 20% more than Urza's Saga. But again, that's third on the list. Very close in second, Psychic Frog, 208 per month. So basically tied for second are Psychic Frog and
Consigned to Memory. This year is bonkers.
Right. I mean, 200 appearances per month.
I just want to remind folks. So let me just go back. So you mentioned last year was the One Ring. Can you guess what we named as the card of the year in 2022?
Oh, gosh, it probably was that a Modern Horizons 2 card?
Nope. It was
darn.
It was Bazeju. Nope.
Oh, yeah. Good one. Very good one. And still a format staple.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. But that begins to tell, I mean, and I'm sure Bazeju didn't come close to, you know, these numbers.
That's right. We weren't tracking that same metric at the time, but I think you're right. Well, and so no surprise that number one on the list, Vexing Bauble, 280 appearances per month. So keep in mind, Black Lotus only has 480 appearances per month. Wasteland has 315. So Vexing Bauble appears almost as much as Wasteland does.
Wow.
About 10% less.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's incredible how popular and dominant Vexing Bauble became. And we don't have to rehash the restriction discussion, but
Kevin,
it was deserving.
In our 2021 winner was Urza's Saga. So that was the Modern Horizons.
Yep.
So it took, you know, what, 3.5-4 years for Urza's Saga to get restricted and 3 months for Vexing Bauble.
Yep. Well, and we talked about in our prior show the interaction between the two and some of the contributing factors for that, of course.
Yeah, wow.
So, Steve, our Moxie discussion is always a fun one because we inevitably come down to this point about quantity versus impact.
Yeah.
Right? And to a lesser degree, performance. Vexing Bauble is all over this format in so many different decks. And it plays, you know, similar roles across those decks, but not entirely the same. And it had the better part of this year to interact with, not the better part of this year, the better part of its tenure this year to interact with 4X Urza Saga as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to temper our observations here a little bit by that. Like the Bauble has been amplified significantly by having 4X Saga to work with for a couple of months.
True.
But the truth is that post-restriction of both of them, it's still showing up in huge numbers.
It was going to be big regardless. So
exactly.
Just to finish our cycle, Kevin, the year before Saga, our card of the year was Lurrus, and the year before that, our card of the year was Force of Vigor. So
yeah, I remembered the Force of Vigor.
So that tells us 2019. It tells you just the last 5 years, our winners have been Force of Vigor, Lurrus, Urza's Saga, Bazeju, the One Ring, and then, I mean, you can see this is rarefied air.
That is an excellent way to put that. Yes. A rarefied air is the perfect way to describe that.
I think that Psychic Frog is a very intriguing card, a very, very powerful creature. But the data you presented is incontrovertible. The winner is Vexing Bauble.
It kind of has to be. And the only argument against it, I would say, is do I like that? Because when you and I reviewed the card, I lamented the fact that it has this sacrifice escape valve, mm-hmm. right? Which, from a design standpoint, I don't enjoy. Let's just put it that way. I don't want to rehash that whole philosophy. But the point is I would prefer that this card was more like Chalice of the Void than having a get out of jail free card, right? Which means, in my opinion, it has that much less interest and tension from a deck construction standpoint. And so. But that doesn't change the fact that even And with a restricted saga and being restricted itself, it's still just an incredibly powerful card that one must account for when building and building against their vintage decks and their vintage opponents. And you can't escape its ubiquity. You might say that Chalice has kind of come and gone. You know, it's relegated to some niche applications at this point. It's really only being played in decks where it would be played as a four of if it could be. But the same is not true for the Bauble. It's, you know, it's playing a couple of different roles and in a couple of different matchups. And that's good. I like that. Overall, you just can't deny its impact, though, to your point. Like, I love me some Psychic Frog and some Consigned to Memory, but this year is going to be the year, when we look back on it, of Vexing Bauble.
I agree. Brief its reign was, but may it continue in restricted form. It's Vexing Bauble. It's not going to be Psychic Frog. Psychic Frog is just another Psychotalk. It will have its day in the sun, and then it will go away. Vexing Bauble is here to stay. I did not intend to rhyme that out, but it's a nice little poem.
All right, it's official. Our Moxie for best new card of 2024 goes to Vexing Bauble. Now we're going to move on to the best new set of the year.
Yes.
And Steve, we had this same problem with Lord of the Rings last year.
Yeah.
Where like the top three cards, that was Lorien revealed Orcish Bowmasters in the One Ring. The top three cards from a count and impact standpoint were all from the same set. And we have that same problem this year.
Yeah.
MH3 was destined to be impactful for Vintage, but the rest of the sets for the year really kind of phoned it in.
Yeah, I mean, they were pretty weak.
The next most played card is just a land that gets you a Surveil action. Like,
an example of those the design ethic that we've covered before, which is creating a situationally superior version of an existing, essentially functionality. Look, I don't think there's any shame in saying that in a year in which a Modern Horizon set is printed, it's just gonna wash out the other sets, you know.
Yeah.
And that's
the odds on favor in any given year. Yeah,
that's fine. That's just a reality. I mean, there's also a possibility we won't see a Modern Horizons type set like that quite again, given how impactful these sets have been to Eternal formats. I think there's been mm-hmm. pretty significant backlash against them, so I don't know what portends for the future, but I do think that what we've seen with MH2 and MH3 could be the end of that sort of thing.
To your point, and I do appreciate the fact that we're not right now nominating one of the five cycle of pitch cards.
Right? Yes. They learned
their
lesson there. They
dialed those back this year, yeah, and made those not quite so dominant.
Right. Well, let's make it formal. Modern Horizons 3 has my Moxie Award for 2024.
Easily.
And you want to make it explicit on your end?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's definitely my Moxie for 2024 as well. Now, let's move on to one that's a little less cut
and
dry.
Yes, the decks.
And that is the best deck of the year. Now, we touched on it a little bit already, and that we have some constellations of top performers along our two favorite metrics, which is
match win percentage,
metagame representation.
Yes, sorry. Go ahead.
And match win percentage.
And Doomsday is number one on match win percentage.
Above a certain threshold of representation at 5%? Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. Good year for Doomsday. Unfortunately, and Doomsday did, you know, it was a stalwart of top eights through all the events we listed earlier in the show. You know, for our tent pole events, Doomsday appeared in one, I'm counting two, three, four, five, six, seven. It was in all but a couple of those tentpole events represented in the top eight. But in every case, only one copy and never the winner. So a really, really strong year and a reliable performance, predictable performance from Doomsday, but never taking home the crown and also never putting more than one player in these top eights.
Yeah.
I think all you can describe that as is a strong performance, but not a great
performance. It shows the disconnect between using match win percentage as the sole criterion. You have to look at the combination of tournament performance and overall representation. I mean, there's a number of things that could be attributed to. It could be the skill required to pilot it correctly. It could be that it has weak spots in the metagame. It could be a combination of both. But whatever the case is, I mean, I looked at some data in preparation for this recording, and Kevin, I was shocked to discover that Discoverin, the infamous Doomsday player, is no longer playing Doomsday, or at least in the most recent Vintage Challenge, he registered an Esper Luris deck. So what does that tell you?
Yes, I saw that. I'm not saying that's a canary in the coal mine, but...
But it really is, yeah.
It's still indicative of something. Yeah, there is no way, I mean, I don't mean this disrespectfully, there's just no way that I can give my Moxie for this year to a deck that, while it had an excellent match win percentage, had such a relatively low metagame representation. Now, if it had been a breakout deck in the last quarter of the year, then we might be talking, but that's not the case. It's a consistent performer all year, but not the best deck, in my opinion. The constellation of decks at the top of the metagame representation, I'll remind our audience, include Luris Saga with the top match win percent, Jeweled Shops, and Initiative. Those top three.
Yeah.
With Dredge kind of on the outside looking in. Dredge had less than 50% match win percent for the year.
That's a rule that out.
Yeah, and Initiative was just above 50%. I think it had 50.5% or 51%. Tough call there. In my opinion, it's undeniable that this is a conversation between Luris Saga and Jewel Shops. And it just so happens, Steve, didn't they split the wins in our tentpole events?
Indeed they did.
Yeah. Jewel Shops had 3 out of the 4 of the Q1 Magic Online events, with Luris having the 4th. And then Luris had, well, not the Vintage Champs. Those were Luris, Dredge. But then Luris won the Vintage Super Qualifier at the end of the year. So 3 out of the 4 tent poles at the end of the year. And then the one big event in the middle, the NYSE, was won by Oath. So there's bookends to the year, right? Three jewels and a Luris at the beginning, and then 3 Lurises at the end of the year with no offsetting jewel, so to speak. But you heard the trend when we talked about the top 8s, too. In every case, it was like 2 jewels and 3 Luris, or 2 jewels and 4 Luris, right? Luris was always, and I don't know how this bears on total metagame representation, but it seems to me that Luris was always putting 3 or 4 in the top 8 consistently, and Jewel Shops just was not quite there. Steve, what other metrics catch your eye in terms of your personal evaluation?
I still like proportion of top eights relative that and relative to the meta. I mean, it's very match win percentage is very close, but I like looking at top eights because top eight combines, call me old fashioned, Kevin, but it combines match win percentage and metagame representation kind of effectively as a heuristic.
Yeah.
We don't have that here, so that's fine. But that's probably what I would use as a tiebreaker. I suspect that Luris just had more top eights.
Well, it clearly did over the first 8 months of the year. I mean, it was in first place in January, February, March, April, May, not June, but then July and August.
Nice.
I mean, 7 out of the first 8 months of the year, it topped Jewel in terms of top 8 percentage. Then, as I alluded to earlier, the community broke up the Luris decks, and so I don't have them aggregated together. But still, I mean, Blue-Black Luris had the top metagame representation in September and October single-handedly. Just Blue-Black Luris did. And then if you add up Blue-Black Luris and Esper, I think they were the top, or they're at least above Jewel Shops in the last 2 months of the year, too. I don't have that math right in front of me, but eyeballing the total deck breakdown, I think they did. So I genuinely believe that Luris bested Jewel Shops, taken as an aggregate, in probably 10 or 11 months this year in terms of top 8 representation. Now, it's quite close in some of those months, and we're talking about the difference between, you know, 5% or less in some cases, but it's undeniable. Across most of the metrics, except overall metagame representation, Saga had the edge over Jewel Shops for the course of the year. Given that they're so close and Saga has the edge, I also tend to favor the deck that finished stronger in the year, and that is undeniably Luris. I mean, it 3 out of the last 4 large events that we covered, Esper Luris won.
Yeah.
And also continuing to put multiple contenders in the top 8.
Well, let's stop.
That's a strong finish to the year.
I don't think there's any need to prop up a straw man here. Why don't you give me your we have the nominees. What is your vote?
I think you can tell. My winner for Moxie for 2024 Deck of the Year is Lurrus Saga.
I'm persuaded.
All right.
I'm there with you. Yeah, we're not splitting the awards this year. It looks like we're gonna be, maybe story might be another story.
Well,
but
yeah, the story one is one that we have definitely differed on in the past. Now, again, our story nominations are purposefully vague and ambiguous, including up to the minute.
Makes
here.
Them fun.
Yeah, it does. So let me just toss out some candidates. It seems undeniable that on this list for the story of the year must be the BNR updates.
Yes.
Now, do you, Ponder is a candidate, but you just can't deny the restrictions that we had in August of this year.
Yeah. Okay.
So those are immediately high on my list.
Yes.
The restriction of both Bauble and Saga in August. There's, you know, I'd like to some years I like to point to the performance of a particular deck, whether it's a standout, a brand new thing, something mechanically novel, right?
Mm-hmm.
This year, that's not high on my list. We had nothing that was a mechanical breakthrough in the year. We had some fun interactions between Bauble and Saga, but that didn't actually create much that was brand new. It was just some new variants of things.
There's kind of, I don't know if this is a story, but there's kind of like a diarrhea of just new cards that really did nothing except for Modern Horizons. Like, I don't know. There is something, okay, I will frame it as a story. We possibly have the most new, the most new, absolute terms, increase in quantity of cards in the vintage format ever, possibly this year.
I can't prove that to you, but my intuition is that that's true.
Yeah.
And that's mostly because we just had a bunch of large sets combined with Modern Horizons 3, combined with Universes Beyond stuff like Fallout and Assassin's Creed. If it's not the top year, it's got to be darn close.
So let's just call that large or largest absolute increase in vintage legal cards ever.
Wow.
Not proportional necessarily, because obviously that would be the first year, but that's...
Can you...
But with combined with very little impact. That seems to me...
Can you imagine, if we'd had this quantity of cards, but this year didn't include Modern Horizons 3?
It would be shockingly bad.
Yeah, this would be a major bummer of a year. We'd be talking about Undercity Sewers as our card of the year.
We'd spend 3-hour podcasts on Undercity Sewers.
Oh, self-burn. I do think that is
that's
story
a concerning
for the year.
Story, honestly. Like this sort of like vomiting of new cards with very little impact or really relevance whatsoever. Like that's.
I don't know how to feel about that. I'm not convinced that that is a very bad thing, and I'm not convinced it's a good thing either. We have dealt with some periods of famine before.
True.
Right? We've had plenty of set reviews where we were really scraping the bottom of the barrel to talk about interesting cards. Like, to use an example that came up earlier, High Noon from Outlaws of Thunder Junction, right? Like, a new Rule of Law Arcane Lab variant. We could have talked about that for more than we did this year, which was none. And we would have in years past. And, you know, you and I are nothing if not able to analyze something. But Modern Horizons 3 is kind of a blessing and a curse, isn't it? Like, it gave us plenty of notable cards. But you said it yourself. Psychic Frog is just another in a line of Ophidian variants. Like, you know, it's better than, say, Dreadhorde Arcanist.
Yes,
I think, but not bombastically so.
No, it's sort of reminiscent. What's the card, Kevin, that's played in Breach? The blue red creature, the gold.
You're talking Sprite
Dragon? Yeah, it sort of feels like it doesn't play like Sprite Dragon, but it's reminiscent of that, like an improvement on previous cards. You know, like just
I can see why you'd say that. Yep, the improvement. Yeah, on an existing archetype, so to speak. And
it doesn't create new strategic possibilities, is what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah. And cards like Sink into Stupor and Witch Enchanter, they're very much in the Boseju mold, which is
their utility,
combining multiple effects of utility. Yeah, and it's something that's better than
unlike
the
Saga, parts. Which afforded new strategic opportunities, or Loras, which afforded new strategic opportunities. Those are or even Force of Vigor, which like essentially allowed Dredge to go manaless. You know, those are all new strategic opportunities. So I agree.
And
even
let's not forget Luris, which is just a an 800-pound gorilla when it comes to impact on the metagame.
Yeah. I wonder if we reach some weird plateau in Vintage where it's really hard to create new strategic possibilities. I doubt it. But it's I'm just throwing that out there.
I agree with you. I don't think that is a tautology. But I agree with you that this year represents a plateau of a kind.
So I do think there is a story here about. Okay, so there's two stories you mentioned. One is this sort of influx of cards with very little impact. The other is sort of like the real absence of new strategies in the format, in a sense, this year.
I agree that that is notable, and honestly. To me, it feels like if you kind of segregate out the immediate impact of Vexing Bauble, there's the early part of this year was characterized a little bit by people wondering, is Saga too good?
Yeah. Right?
Should we excise Saga from this format?
I think we were of that opinion a year ago, and it just took a while to do it. So, Kevin, I think one of the things that's difficult is disentangling simultaneous restrictions. If Saga had just been restricted and in a separate event, Bauble had been restricted, how would you have viewed those relative to each other? Which would you have seen as the bigger story?
I would have, in hindsight, if that had come to pass, I would have viewed Vexing Bauble as something of a flash in the pan.
Yes.
And Saga's restriction as the kind of sea change in the format. Because if it had happened the way you describe, that would have been a more impactful pivot point where we all kind of collectively acknowledged, all right, we've got to change how we build. You know, we've relied on Saga in such ways for too long. What does it do to deck construction? Things like Lorien Revealed becoming much less numerous in terms
of the downstream
on Saga mana bases. Yeah, which we talked about last year. I would have viewed Bauble as just that was exciting, for 2 months or whatever. But the story, the Saga restriction would have been a much bigger deal. And I believe that's the case, right?
Yeah.
And you and I discussed it when we discussed the restrictions that they both shouldn't have happened at once is the simplest way to put it. Like we should have done one or the other.
So here's something else to think about. If Saga and Bauble had been restricted separately, then I think there would be a real case for Modern Horizons 3 being a story of the year. Because then we would think about Modern Horizons 3, the impact of it is flowing into the restriction of Bauble. And again, set releases, if they're sufficiently broad and impactful, can be a story. You know, sort of the metagame effects of Modern Horizons 3 or other sets. So I'm going to nominate that anyway as a story, but it's obviously entangled with the restrictions in August. And, we could separate out those restrictions, but I don't think it makes sense to. They are part of the same narrative event. So, I've nominated three new stories beyond the August restriction. Would you like to enter any other candidates?
There's nothing that rises to that level. I am noting that, there's some smaller things like the Vintage community taking an opportunity to update our taxonomy when it comes to archetypes and sub-archetypes. That's not a big impactful thing. It's just the sort of thing that you and I deal with more often than the average folks. But that doesn't rise to the level of what we're talking about. I think this list we've already got is presumptively the best list. Because one of the tests that you and I like to use for how we finalize our nominations is, what are we going to look back at this year and remember?
Yes.
And the duality and the interaction of what you just said about Modern Horizons 3 catalyzing the Saga restriction, I'm coming around to the notion that it's actually the intersection of those two things. It's not just the restriction, because that impact was not actually that enormous, as I alluded to earlier. You know, we didn't have a big shakeup in the metagame. We had incremental change in the metagame. There was still the top deck, and the top deck was still the top deck. And Modern Horizons 3, while it injected a handful of good new cards, it didn't do, as you said earlier, it didn't introduce new strategic objectives. It just incrementalized on decks we had. But that was a real inflection point in the middle of the year that really focuses our attention on what came before it and what came after it. And that's how I'm going to remember this year. And even though Psychic Frog, as you said, is a cool card, and we both love it, and it's going to be around to stay, maybe 2025 is the year of Psychic Frog, right?
It will not win our new card Moxie, but it could win the story of the year or the deck of the year. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
So, Kevin, I hear a convergence. I hear a conclusion. Would you like to go on record?
I don't know how to label this thing I'm talking about, but Modern Horizons catalyzing the restrictions in August of Saga and Bauble feels like the event this year that we're going to remember, that defines the year. And if you're comfortable with that framing, then that's what I'm pitching.
Yeah.
Would you edit that or revise that framing in any way?
Say it one more time for the record.
Modern Horizons catalyzing the restriction of Urza Saga and with it Vexing Bauble.
No, I don't think I agree with that, but I'm fine with you making that your Moxie. I think that Urza Saga had sort of built up and was ultimately and independently deserving of restriction and was inevitable, regardless of Modern Horizons 3.
You know, I think I simultaneously agree with you, but I would also point out that if it wasn't for Vexing Bauble, what would have done it? I believe we could still be in a 4 Saga metagame right now.
Fair enough. It's really hard to know what the DCI is. I mean, we have the DCI. We have Wizards. We have Wizards' statement. You know, they do pay close attention to, it's not like every discussion they had to do a deep dive into Vintage. I think it was something that probably would have happened the next time they looked closely at the format Saga was going to go. And I think
could be.
It's possible, though, that Bauble's effect caused them to precipitated the close inspection that ultimately also resulted in that simultaneous restriction of Saga. But I think whenever they were going to take a look at the data, Saga was going to get the axe. So I think you should go with that narrative. I think if that's how you view it, then make your Moxie the, and you can frame it however you like, right? That's the beauty of this. So you can say, you know, Modern Horizons impact resulting in restrictions. And I will just more narrowly focus the story of the year from my Moxie as being the August 2024 restrictions.
Okay. So we're not too far removed in terms of our assessment of the way this year feels.
Yeah.
And how we view it in hindsight.
Yeah. It's going to be odd. It's going to be like, you know, I don't know. It's hard to describe because it's sort of like the restriction of Consultation and Necropotence. They are in the same deck, but they have very different sort of tactical and strategic impacts on the format, in a sense.
I completely agree. Completely agree. And I wish we'd had our alternate timeline where we got to see some of these things play out, because there's multiple versions of reality that we and I have theorized about here.
Someday the super...
They're all kind of equally fascinating.
Someday the super sentient, intelligent AI will do all of this for us, but we're not quite there. Well, this was fun. Thank you so much, Kevin, for doing really the yeoman's labor here in stitching together a phenomenal data set. I've done that in the past. I know how hard it is. I appreciate your effort.
Thank you for saying so.
So good to...
It's always worth it in the end.
It really is. It gives you such clarity when you look at the format. And then also, here's to, hopefully an interesting year coming up. Kevin, the next set coming out will be in February, and that will be, remind me...
The next set is Aether Drift.
Okay.
So a return to Kaladesh, but with the spin of Death Race 5000 or whatever. Jury's out on how the flavor of the set will go, but given that it's not a Modern Horizons set, I mean, so the over under on playable cards is set at 0.5
for Vintage. Oh well. Well, we're committed to again being there with you through it. If there's things worth talking about, we will record an episode. You know, tell us what you think of this episode, email us, reach us however you can. Thanks for listening.
Totally agree. And thank you, Steve. Everything you said about doing the work is, I echo that in terms of your analysis. It's always a pleasure to talk about these things with you and about how they reflect off of each of our perspectives a little differently. And with that, thank you for listening to episode 11D5 of So Many Insane Plays. You can, blue sky us individually. I'm Kevin Crone. Steve, what's your handle on Blue Sky?
Same, S. Menendian.
So same as Twitter, I think, for the both of us. And you can email us at somanyinsaneplayspodcast@gmail.com. Please stay tuned about where our alternate posting medium will be. I don't even know it at this time. If you have any recommendations for another place to get podcasts, just send us an email, because I'd love to see where our audience goes aside from Eternal Central. As always, and until next year, we wish you many insane plays.
Game!